havoc of blood and entrails. Riders were towing bodies out of the bloody waters of the lake, and the froth that rode lightly on the beach was a pale pink in the rising light. They moved among the dead, harvesting the long black locks with their knives, and leaving their victims raw-skulled and strange in their bloody calls. The loosed horses from the Remuda came pounding down the reeking strand and disappeared in the smoke, and after a while they came pounding back. Men were wading about in the red waters, hacking aimlessly at the dead, and some lay coupled to the bludgeoned bodies of young women, dead or dying on the beach. One of the Delawares passed with a collection of heads like some strange vendor bound for market, the hair twisted about his wrist and the heads dangling and turning together. Glanton knew that every moment on this ground must be contested later in the desert, and he rode among the men and urged them on. McGill came out of the crackling fires and stood staring bleakly at the scene about. He had been skewered through with a lance, and he held the stock of it before him. It was fashioned from a sotal stock, and the point of an old cavalry sword, bound at the haft, curved from out the small of his back. The kid waded out of the water and approached him, and the Mexican sat down carefully in the sand.
"Get away from him," said Glanton.
McGill turned to look at Glanton, and as he did so, Glanton leveled his pistol and shot him through the head. He reholstered the gun and stood his empty rifle upright against the saddle and held it with his knee while he measured powder down the barrels. Someone shouted to him. The horse trembled and stepped back, and Glanton spoke to it softly and patched two balls and drove them home. He was watching a rise to the north where a band of mounted Apaches were grouped against the sky. They were perhaps a quarter mile distant, 5-6 of them, their cries thin and lost. Glanton brought the rifle to the crook of his arm and capped one drum and rotated the barrels and capped the other. He didn't take his eyes from the Apaches. Webster stepped from his horse and drew his rifle and slid the ramrod from the thimbles and went to one knee, the ramrod upright in the sand, resting the rifle's forestock upon the fist with which he held it. The rifle had set triggers, and he cocked the rear one and laid his face against the cheekpiece. He reckoned the drift of the wind, and he reckoned against the sun on the side of the silver foresight, and he held high and touched off the piece. Glanton sat immobile. The shot was flat and dead in the emptiness, and the gray smoke drifted away. The leader of the group on the rise sat his horse, then he slowly pitched sideways and fell to the ground. Glanton gave a whoop and surged forward. Four men followed. The warriors on the rise had dismounted and were lifting up the fallen man. Glanton turned in the saddle without taking his eyes from the Indians and held out his rifle to the nearest man. This man was Sam Tate, and he took the rifle and reined his horse so short he nearly threw it. Glanton and the three rode on, and Tate drew the ramrod for a rest and crouched and fired. The horse that carried the wounded chief faltered, ran on. He swiveled the barrels and fired the second charge, and it plowed to the ground. The Apaches reined with shrill cries. Glanton leaned forward and spoke into his horse's ear. The Indians raised up their leader to a new mount, and riding double, they flailed at their horses and set out again. Glanton had drawn his pistol, and he gestured with it to the men behind, and one pulled up his horse and leaped to the ground and went flat on his belly, and drew and cocked his own pistol and pulled down the loading lever, and stuck it in the sand, and holding the gun in both hands, with his chin buried in the ground, he sighted along the barrel. The horses were 200 yards out and moving fast. With the second shot, the pony that bore the leader bucked, and a rider alongside reached and took the reins. They were attempting to take the leader off the wounded animal in mid-stride when the animal collapsed. Glanton was first to reach the dying man, and he knelt with that alien and barbarous head cradled between his thighs like some reeking outland nurse, and dared off the savages with his revolver. They circled on the plain and shook their bows and lofted a few arrows at him, and then turned and rode on. Blood bubbled from the man's chest, and he turned his lost eyes upward, already glazed, the capillaries breaking up. In those dark pools there sat each a small and perfect sun. He rode back to the camp at the fore of his small column, with the chief's head hanging by its hair from his belt. The men were stringing up scalps on strips of leather whang, and some of the dead lay with broad slices of hide cut from their backs to be used for the making of belts and harnesses. The dead Mexican McGill had been scalped, and the bloody skulls were already blackening in the sun. Most of the wickiups were burned to the ground, and because some gold coins had been found, a few of the men were kicking through the smoldering ashes. Glanton cursed them on, taking up a lance and mounting the head upon it, where it bobbed and leered like a carnival head, and riding up and back, calling to them to round up the caballado and move out. When he turned his horse, he saw the judge sitting on the ground. The judge had taken off his hat and was drinking water from a leather bottle. He looked up at Glanton.
"It's not him."
"What's that?" The judge nodded.
"That."
Glanton turned the shaft. The head with its long dark locks swung about to face him.
"Who do you think it is, if it ain't him?"
The judge shook his head.
"It's not Gomez."
He nodded toward the thing.
"That gentleman is Sangre Puro.
Gomez is Mexican."
"He ain't all Mexican."
"You can't be all Mexican. It's like being all mongrel. But that's not Gomez, because I've seen Gomez, and it's not him."
"Will it pass for him?"
"No." Glanton looked toward the north. He looked down at the judge.
"You ain't seen my dog, have you?"
he said. The judge shook his head.
"Do you intend to drive that stock?"
"Until I'm made to quit."
"That might be soon."
"That might be."
"How long do you think it will take these yahoos to regroup?"
Glanton spat. It wasn't a question, and he didn't answer it.
"Where's your horse?"
he said.
"Gone." "Well, if you aim to ride with us, you better be for getting another one."
He looked at the head on the pole.
"You is some kind of goddamn chief," he said.
He nudged the horse forward with his heels and rode out along the water's edge. The Delawares were wading about in the lake, feeling for sunken bodies with their feet. He sat there a moment, and then he turned the horse and rode up through the sacked encampment. He rode warily, his pistol across his thigh. He followed the tracks coming down from the desert where they'd ridden in. When he returned, he had with him the scalp of the old man who had first stood up out of the bushes at dawn. Within the hour, they were mounted and riding south, leaving behind them on the scourged shore of the lake a shambles of blood and salt and ashes, and driving before them a half a thousand horses and mules. The judge rode at the head of the column, bearing on the saddle before him a strange, dark child covered with ash. Part of its hair was burned away, and it rode mute and stoic, watching the land advance before it with huge black eyes, like some changeling. The men as they rode turned black in the sun from the blood on their clothes and their faces, and then paled slowly in the rising dust until they assumed once more the color of the land through which they passed. They rode all day, with Glanton bringing up the rear of the column. Toward noon, the dog caught them up. His chest was dark with blood, and Glanton carried him on the pommel of the saddle until he could recruit himself. In the long afternoon, he trotted in the shadow of the horse, and in the twilight, he trotted far out on the plain, where the tall shapes of the horses skated over the chaparral on spider legs. By now, there was a thin line of dust to the north, and they rode on into dark, and the Delawares dismounted and lay with their ears to the ground. And then they mounted up, and all rode on again. When they halted, Glanton ordered fires built, and the wounded seen to. One of the mares had foaled in the desert, and this frail form soon hung skewered on a Palo Verde pole over the raked coals, while the Delawares passed among themselves a gourd containing the curdled milk taken from its stomach. From a slight rise to the west of the camp, the fires of the enemy were visible 10 miles to the north. The company squatted in their blood-stiffened hides and counted the scalps and strung them on poles, the blue-black hair dull and clotted with blood. David Brown went among these haggard butchers as they crouched before the flames, but he could find him no surgeon. He carried an arrow in his thigh, fletching and all, and none would touch it. Least of all would Doc Irving, for Brown called him a mortician and a barber, and they kept their distance one from the other.
"Boys," said Brown, "I'd doctify it myself, but I can't get no straight grip."
The judge looked up at him and smiled.
"Will you do her, Holden?"
"No, Davy, I won't. But I tell you what I will do."
"What's that?"
"I'll write a policy on your life against every mishap save the noose."
"Damn you, then."
The judge chuckled. Brown glared about him.
"Will none of you help a man?"
None spoke.
"Damn all of you, then," he said.
He sat and stretched his leg out on the ground and looked at it, he bloodier than most. He gripped the shaft and bore down on it. The sweat stood on his forehead. He held his leg and swore softly. Some watched, some didn't. The kid rose.
"I'll try her," he said. "Good lad," said Brown.
He fetched his saddle to lean against. He turned his leg to the fire for the light and folded his belt and held it and hissed down at the boy kneeling there.
"Grip her stout, lad, and drive her straight."
Then he gripped the belt in his teeth and lay back. The kid took hold of the shaft close to the man's thigh and pressed forward with his weight. Brown seized the ground on either side of him, and his head flew back and his wet teeth shone in the firelight. The kid took a new grip and bore down again. The veins in the man's neck stood like ropes, and he cursed the boy's soul. On the fourth essay, the point of the arrow came through the flesh of the man's thigh, and blood ran over the ground. The kid sat back on his heels and passed the sleeve of his shirt across his brow. Brown let the belt fall from his teeth.
"Is it through?"
he said.
"It is." "The point. Is it the point? Speak up, man."
The kid drew his knife and cut away the bloody point deftly and handed it up. Brown held it to the firelight and smiled. The point was of hammered copper, and it was cocked in its blood-soaked bindings on the shaft, but it had held.
"Stout lad, you'll make a shade tree sawbones yet. Now draw her."
The kid withdrew the shaft from the man's leg smoothly, and the man bowed on the ground in a lurid female motion and wheezed raggedly through his teeth. He lay there a moment, and then he sat up and took the shaft from the kid and threw it in the fire, and rose and went off to make his bed. When the kid returned to his own blanket, the ex-priest leaned to him and hissed at his ear.
"Fool," he said, "God will not love ye forever."
The kid turned to look at him.
"Don't you know he'd have took you with him? He'd have took you, boy, like a bride to the altar."
They rose up and moved on sometime after midnight. Glanton had ordered the fires built up, and they rode out with the flames lighting all the grounds about, and the shadow shapes of the desert brush reeling on the sands, and the riders treading their thin and flaring shadows until they had crossed altogether into the darkness which so well became them. The horses and mules were ranged far out over the desert, and they picked them up for miles to the south and drove them on. The sourceless summer lightning marked out of the night dark mountain ranges at the rim of the world, and the half-wild horses on the plain before them trotted in those bluish strobes like horses called forth quivering out of the abyss. In the smoking dawn, the party, riding ragged and bloody with their baled peltries, looked less like victors than the harried afterguard of some ruined army retreating across the meridians of chaos and old night, the horses stumbling, the men tottering asleep in their saddles. The broached day discovered the same barren countryside about, and the smoke from their fires of the night before stood thin and windless to the north. The pale dust of the enemy, who were to hound them to the gates of the city, seemed no nearer, and they shambled on through the rising heat, driving the crazed horses before them. Mid-morning, they watered at a stagnant pothole that had already been walked through by 300 animals, the riders hazing them out of the water and dismounting to drink from their hats, and then riding on again down the dry bed of the stream, and clattering over the stony ground, dry rocks and boulders, and then the desert soil again, red and sandy, and the constant mountains about them thinly grassed and grown with ocotillo and sotal, and the secular aloes blooming like phantasmagoria in a feverland. At dusk they sent riders west to build fires on the prairie, and the company lay down in the dark and slept while bats crossed silently overhead among the stars. When they rode on in the morning it was still dark, and the horses all but fainting. Day found the heathen much advanced upon them. They fought their first stand the dawn following, and they fought them running for 8 days and nights, on the plain and among the rocks and the mountains, and from the walls and azoteas of abandoned haciendas, and they lost not a man. On the third night they crouched in the keep of old walls of slumped mud, with the fires of the enemy not a mile distant on the desert. The judge sat with the Apache boy before the fire, and had watched everything with dark, berry eyes, and some of the men played with it and made it laugh, and they gave it jerky, and it sat chewing and watching gravely the figures that passed above it. They covered it with a blanket, and in the morning the judge was dandling it on one knee while the men saddled their horses. Toadvine saw him with the child as he passed with his saddle, but when he came back 10 minutes later, leading his horse, the child was dead, and the judge had scalped it. Toadvine put the muzzle of his pistol against the great dome of the judge's head.
"God damn you, Holden!"
"You either shoot or take that away. Do it now." Toadvine put the pistol in his belt. The judge smiled and wiped the scalp on the leg of his trousers and rose and turned away. Another 10 minutes, and they were on the plain again in full flight from the Apaches. On the afternoon of the fifth day, they were crossing a dry pan at a walk, driving the horses before them, the Indians behind, just out of rifle range, calling out to them in Spanish. From time to time, one of the company would dismount with rifle and wiping stick, and the Indians would flare like quail, pulling their ponies around and standing behind them. To the east, trembling in the heat, stood the thin white walls of a hacienda, and the trees thin and green and rigid rising from it like a scene viewed in a diorama. An hour later they were driving the horses, perhaps now 100 head, along these walls and down a worn trail toward a spring. A young man rode out and welcomed them formally in Spanish. No one answered. The young rider looked down along the creek where the fields were laid out with acequias, and where the workers in their dusty white costumes stood poised with hoes among the new cotton or waist-high corn. He looked back to the northwest. The Apaches, 70, 80 of them, were just coming past the first of a row of jacales and defiling along the path and into the shade of the trees. The peons in the fields saw them at about the same time. They flung their implements from them and began to run, some shrieking, some with their hands atop their heads. The young Don looked at the Americans, and he looked at the approaching savages again. He called out something in Spanish. The Americans drove the horses up out of the spring and on through the grove of cottonwoods. The last they saw of him, he had drawn a small pistol from his boot and had turned to face the Indians. That evening they led the Apaches through the town of Gallego, the street a mud gutter patrolled by swine and wretched hairless dogs. It appeared deserted. The young corn in the roadside fields had been washed by recent rains and stood white and luminous, bleached almost transparent by the sun. They rode most of the night, and the next day the Indians were still there. They fought them again at Encinias, and they fought them in the dry passes going toward El Sauce, and beyond in the low foothills from which they could already see the church spires of the city to the south. On the 21st of July, in the year 1849, they rode into the city of Chihuahua to a hero's welcome. Driving the harlequin horses before them through the dust of the streets in a pandemonium of teeth and whited eyes. Small boys ran among the hooves, and the victors in their gory rags smiled through the filth and the dust and the caked blood as they bore on poles the desiccated heads of the enemy through that fantasy of music and flowers. Chapter 13. At the baths, merchants, trophies of war, the banquet, Trias, the ball, north, Coyame, the border, the Hueco tanks, massacre of the Tiwas, Carisao, a desert spring, the Medanos, an inquest concerning teeth, Nacori, the cantina, a desperate encounter, into the mountains, a village decimated, mounted lancers, a skirmish, pursuing the survivors, the plains of Chihuahua, slaughter of the soldiers, a burial, Chihuahua, westward. Their progress was swelled by new riders, by boys on muleback, an old man in plaited hats, and a deputation that took charge of the captured horses and mules and hazed them on through the narrow streets toward the bull ring where they could be kept. The tattered campaigners surged on, some now holding aloft cups that had been pressed upon them, waving to the ladies clustered on the balconies their putrescent hats, and elevating the bobbing heads with those strange half-lidded looks of ennui into which the features had dried, all so hemmed about now by the citizenry that they seemed the vanguard of some ragged uprising, and heralded before by a pair of drummers, one witless and both barefoot, and by a trumpeter who marched with one arm raised above his head in a martial gesture and playing the while. In this manner they passed through the standing portals of the governor's palace, over the worn stone sills and into the courtyard, where the broomed hooves of the mercenaries' shoeless horses subsided upon the cobbles with a curious turtle-like clatter. Hundreds of onlookers pressed about as the dried scalps were counted out upon the stones. Soldiers with muskets kept back the crowds, and young girls watched the Americans with huge black eyes, and boys crept forth to touch the grisly trophies. There were 128 scalps and 8 heads, and the governor's lieutenant and his retinue came down into the courtyard to welcome them and admire their work. They were promised full payment in gold at the dinner to be held in their honor that evening at the Riddle and Stevens Hotel. And with this the Americans sent up a cheer and mounted their horses again. Old women in black rebosos ran forth to kiss the hems of their reeking shirts and hold up their dark little hands in blessing, and the riders wheeled their gaunted mounts and pushed through the clamoring multitude and into the street. They moved on to the public baths, where they descended one by one into the waters, each more pale than the one before, and all tattooed, branded, sutured. The great puckered scars, inaugurated God knows where by what barbarous surgeons across chests and abdomens, like the tracks of gigantic millipedes. Some deformed, fingers missing, eyes, their foreheads and arms stamped with letters and numbers, as if they were articles requiring inventory. Citizens of both sexes withdrew along the walls and watched the water turn into a thin gruel of blood and filth, and none could take their eyes from the judge, who had disrobed last of all, and now walked the perimeter of the baths with a cigar in his mouth, and a regal air, testing the waters with one toe, surprisingly petite. He shone like the moon, so pale he was, and not a hair to be seen anywhere upon that vast corpus, not in any crevice, nor in the great bores of his nose, and not upon his chest, nor in his ears, nor any tuft at all above his eyes, nor to the lids thereof. The immense and gleaming dome of his naked skull looked like a cap for bathing, pulled down to the otherwise darkened skin of his face and neck. As that great bulk lowered itself into the bath, the waters rose perceptibly, and when he had submerged himself to the eyes, he looked about with considerable pleasure. The eyes slightly crinkled, as if he were smiling under the water like some pale and bloated manatee surfaced in a bog, while behind his small and close-set ear, the wedged cigar smoked gently just above the waterline. By now merchants had spread their wares all along the clay tiles behind them, suits of European cloth and cut, and shirts of colored silks, and close-napped beaver hats, and fine Spanish leather boots, silver-headed canes and riding crops, and silver-mounted saddles, and carven pipes and hideout guns, and a group of Toledo swords with ivory hilts and nicely chased blades. And barbers were setting up chairs to receive them, crying out the names of celebrated patrons upon whom they had attended, and all of these entrepreneurs assuring the company of credit on the most generous terms. When they crossed the square, attired in their new haberdashery, some with coat sleeves barely past their elbows, the scalps were being strung about the iron fretwork of the gazebo like decorations for some barbaric celebration. The severed heads had been raised on poles above the lampstanders, where they now contemplated with their caved and pagan eyes the dry hides of their kinsmen and forebears, strung across the stone facade of the cathedral and clacking lightly in the wind. Later, when the lamps were lit, the heads in the soft glare of the uplight assumed the look of tragic masks, and within a few days they would become mottled white and altogether leprous with the droppings of the birds that roosted upon them. This Angel Trias, who was governor, had been sent abroad as a young man for his education, and was widely read in the classics, and was a student of languages. He was also a man among men, and the rough warriors he'd hired for the protection of the state seemed to warm something in him. When the lieutenant invited Glanton and his officers to dine, Glanton replied that he and his men did not keep separate mess. The lieutenant yielded the point with a smile, and Trias had done the same. They arrived in good order, shaved and shorn, and turned out in their new boots and finery. The Delawares, strangely austere and menacing in their morning coats, all together about the table set for them. Cigars were presented, and glasses of sherry poured, and the governor standing at the head of the table made them welcome, and issued orders to his chamberlain that every need be seen to. Soldiers attended them, fetching extra glasses, pouring the wine, lighting cigars from a wick in a silver holder designed for just that purpose. The judge arrived last of all, dressed in a well-cut suit of unbleached linen that had been made for him that very afternoon. Whole bolts of cloth exhausted, and squads of tailors as well, in that fabrication. His feet were encased in nicely polished gray kid boots, and in his hand he held a Panama hat that had been spliced together from two such lesser hats by such painstaking work that the joinery did scarcely show at all. Trias had already taken his seat when the judge made his appearance. But no sooner had the governor seen him than he rose again, and they shook hands cordially, and the governor had him seated at his right, and they at once fell into conversation in a tongue none other in that room spoke at all, saving for random vile epithets drifted down from the north. The ex-priest was sat opposite the kid, and he raised his brows and motioned toward the head of the table with a swing of his eyes. The kid, in the first starched collar he'd ever owned, and the first cravat, sat mute as a tailor's dummy at that board. By now the table was fully commenced, and there was a tandem run of dishes, fish and fowl and beef and wild meats of the countryside, and a roast shoat on a platter, and casseroles of savories and trifles and glacés, and bottles of wine and brandy from the vineyards at El Paso. Patriotic toasts were drunk, the governor's aides raising their glasses to Washington and Franklin, and the Americans responding with yet more of their own country's heroes, ignorant alike of diplomacy and any name at all from the pantheon of their sister republic. They fell to, and they continued to eat until they had exhausted first the banquet and then the larder of the hotel altogether. Couriers were sent abroad through the city to fetch more, only to have this also vanish, and more sent for, until Riddle's cook barricaded the door with his body, and the soldiers and attendants took to simply dumping great trays of pastries, fried meat skins, rounds of cheese, whatever they could find, out upon the table. The governor had tapped his glass and risen to speak in his well-phrased English, but the bloated and belching mercenaries were leering about and were calling for more drink, and some had not ceased to scream out toasts, now degenerated into obscene pledges to the horrors of various southern cities. The bursar was introduced to cheers, catcalls, hoisted bumpers. Glanton took charge of the long canvas bag stamped with the state cartouche, and cutting the governor short, he rose and dumped the gold out onto the table among the bones and rinds and pools of spilled drink, and in a brisk drumhead disbursement divided out the pile of gold with the blade of his knife, so that each man was paid his spoken share and no further ceremony to it. A sort of skiffle band had struck up a lugubrious air in one corner of the hall, and first up was the judge, who ushered the players and their instruments into the adjoining ballroom, where a number of ladies who had been sent for sat already about the walls on benches and fanned themselves without apparent alarm. The Americans debouched into the dance hall by ones and twos and by groups, chairs pushed back, chairs pushed over to lie where they fell. Wall lamps and their tin reflectors had been lit all about the room, and the celebrants foregathered there cast conflicting shadows. The scalp-hunters stood grinning at the dames, churlish-looking in their shrunken clothes, sucking their teeth, armed with knives and pistols, and mad about the eyes. The judge was in close conference with the band, and soon a quadrille was struck up. A great lurching and stomping ensued, while the judge, affable, gallant, squired first one and then another of the ladies through the steps with an easy niceness. By midnight the governor had excused himself, and members of the band had begun to slip away. A blind street harpist stood terrified upon the banquet table among the bones and platters, and a horde of lurid-looking whores had infiltrated the dance. Pistol fire soon became general, and Mr. Riddle, who was acting American consul in the city, descended to remonstrate with the revelers and was warned away. Fights broke out. Furniture was disassembled, men waving chair legs, candle stands. Two whores grappled and pitched into a sideboard and went to the floor in a crash of brandy glasses. Jackson, pistols drawn, lurched into the street, vowing to shoot the ass off Jesus Christ, the long-legged white son of a bitch. At dawn, the shapes of insensate topers lay snoring about the floor among dark patches of drying blood. Bathcat and the harpist lay asleep upon the banquet table in one another's arms. A family of thieves were tiptoeing through the wreckage, turning out the pockets of the sleepers. and the remains of a bonfire that had consumed a good part of the hotel's furnishings smoldered in the street before the door. These scenes and scenes like them were repeated night after night. The citizenry made address to the governor, but he was much like the sorcerer's apprentice, who could indeed provoke the imp to do his will, but could in no way make him cease again. The baths had become bordellos, the attendants driven off. The white stone fountain in the plaza was filled at night with naked and drunken men. Cantinas were evacuated as if by fire, with the appearance of any two of the company. And the Americans found themselves in ghost taverns with drinks on the tables and cigars still burning in the clay ashtrays. Horses were ridden indoors and out, and as the gold began to dwindle away, shopkeepers found themselves presented with debits scrawled on butcher paper in a foreign language for whole shelves of goods. Stores began to close. Charcoal scrawls appeared on the lime-washed walls. Mejor los indios! The evening streets stood empty, and there were no paseos, and the young girls of the city were boarded up and seen no more. On the 15th of August, they rode out. A week later, a company of drovers reported them investing the town of Coyame, 80 miles to the northeast. The village of Coyame had for some years been laid under annual contribution by Gomez and his band. When Glanton and his men rode in, they were fallen upon as saints. Women ran alongside the horses to touch their boots, and presents of every kind were pressed upon them until each man rode with an embarrassment of melons and pastries and trussed chickens gathered in the bow of his saddle. When they rode out 3 days later, the streets stood empty. Not even a dog followed them to the gates. They traveled northeast as far as the town of Presidio on the Texas border, and they crossed the horses and rode dripping through the streets. A soil where Glanton was subject to arrest. He rode out alone on the desert and sat the horse, and he and the horse and the dog looked out across the rolling scrubland and the barren peppercorn hills and the mountains and the flat brush country and running plain beyond, where 400 miles to the east were the wife and child he would not see again. His shadow grew long before him on the banded wash of sand. He would not follow. He had taken off his hat for the evening wind to cool him, and at length he put it on again and turned the horse and rode back. They wandered the borderland for weeks, seeking some sign of the Apache. Deployed upon that plain, they moved in a constant elision, ordained agents of the actual, dividing out the world which they encountered and leaving what had been and what would never be alike extinguished on the ground behind them. Specter horsemen, pale with dust, anonymous in the crenellated heat. Above all else, they appeared wholly adventure, primal, provisional, devoid of order. Like beings provoked out of the absolute rock, and set nameless and at no remove from their own loomings, to wander ravenous and doomed and mute as gorgons, shambling the brutal wastes of Gondwanaland in a time before nomenclature was, and each was all. They killed wild meat, and they took what they required by way of commissary from the pueblos and estancias through which they passed. One evening, almost within sight of the town of El Paso, they looked off toward the north where the Jalenos wintered, and they knew they would not be going there. They camped that night at the Hueco tanks, a group of natural stone cisterns in the desert. The rocks about in every sheltered place were covered with ancient paintings, and the judge was soon among them, copying out those certain ones into his book to take away with him. They were of men and animals, and of the chase, and there were curious birds and arcane maps, and there were constructions of such singular vision as to justify every fear of man and the things that are in him. Of these etchings, some bright yet with color, there were hundreds, And yet the judge went among them with assurance, tracing out the very ones which he required. When he had done, and while there yet was light, he returned to a certain stone ledge and sat a while, and studied again the work there. Then he rose, and with a piece of broken chert he scaffolded away one of the designs, leaving no trace of it, only a raw place on the stone where it had been. Then he put up his book and returned to the camp. In the morning they rode out to the south. Little was said, nor were they quarrelsome among themselves. In 3 days they would fall upon a band of peaceful Tiwas camped on the river and slaughter them, every soul. On the eve of that day they crouched about the fire where it hissed in a softly falling rain, and they ran balls and cut patches as if the fate of the Aborigines had been cast into shape by some other agency altogether, as if such destinies were prefigured in the very rock for those with eyes to read. No man stood to tender them a defense. Toadvine and the Kid conferred together, and when they rode out at noon the day following, they trotted their horses alongside Bathcat. They rode in silence.
"Them sons of bitches ain't bothering nobody," Toadvine said.
The Van Diemenlander looked at him. He looked at the livid letters tattooed on his forehead, and at the lank, greasy hair that hung from his earless skull. He looked at the necklace of gold teeth at his chest. They rode on. They approached those wretched pavilions in the long light of the day's failing, coming up from downwind along the south bank of the river where they could smell the wood smoke of the cook fires. When the first dogs barked, Glanton rowled his horse forward, and they came out of the trees and across the dry scrub with the long necks of the horses leaning out of the dust, avid as hounds, and the riders quirting them on into the sun where the shapes of the women rising up from their tasks stood flat and rigid in silhouette for a moment before they could quite believe in the reality of that dusty pandemoniac pounding down upon them. They stood dumb, barefoot, clad in the unbleached cotton of the country. They clutched cooking ladles, naked children. At the first fire, a dozen of them crumpled and fell. The others had begun to run, old people flinging up their hands, children tottering and blinking in the pistol fire. A few young men ran out with drawn bows and were shot down, and then the riders were all through the village trampling down the grass wickiups and bludgeoning the shrieking householders. Long past dark that night, when the moon was already up, a party of women that had been upriver drying fish returned to the village and wandered howling through the ruins. A few fires still smoldered on the ground, and dogs slank off from among the corpses. An old woman knelt at the blackened stones before her door and poked brush into the coals and blew back a flame from the ashes and began to right the overturned pots. All about her the dead lay, with their peeled skulls, like polyps bluely wet, or luminescent melons cooling on some mesa of the moon. In the days to come, the frail black rebuses of blood in those sands would crack and break and drift away, so that in the circuit of few suns all trace of the destruction of these people would be erased. The desert wind would salt their ruins, and there would be nothing, nor ghost nor scribe, to tell any pilgrim in his passing how it was the people that lived in this place, and in this place died. The Americans entered the town of Carrizal late in the afternoon of the second day following, their horses festooned with the reeking scalps of the Tiwas. This town had fallen almost to ruin. Many of the houses stood empty, and the Presidio was collapsing back into the earth out of which it had been raised, and the inhabitants seemed themselves made vacant by old terrors. They watched the passing of that blood-stained argosy through their streets with dark and solemn eyes. Those riders seemed journeyed from a legendary world, and they left behind a strange tincture, like an after-image on the eye, and the air they disturbed was altered and electric. They passed along the ruinous walls of the cemetery, where the dead were trestled up in niches, and the grounds strewn with bones and skulls and broken pots, like some more ancient ossuary. Other ragged folk appeared in the dusty streets behind them and stood looking after. That night they camped at a warm spring atop a hill amid old traces of Spanish masonry, and they stripped and descended like acolytes into the water while huge white leeches willowed away over the sands. When they rode out in the morning, it was still dark. Lightning stood in ragged chains far to the south, silent, the staccato mountains bespoken blue and barren out of the void. Day broke upon a smoking reach of desert, darkly clouded, where the riders could count 5 separate storms spaced upon the shores of the round earth. They were riding in pure sand, and the horses labored so hugely that the men were obliged to dismount and lead them, toiling up steep eskers where the wind blew the white pumice from the crests like the spume from sea swells, and the sand was scalloped and frailly shaped, and nothing else was there save random polished bones. They were all day among the dunes, and in the evening coming down from the last low sandhills to the plain below among catclaw and crucifixion thorn, they were a parched and haggard lot, man and beast. Harpy eagles flew up screaming from a dead mule and wheeled off westward into the sun as they led the horses out onto the plain. 2 nights later, bivouacked in a pass in the mountains, they could see the distant lights of the city below them. They crouched along a shale ridge in the leeward wall of the gap while the fire sawed in the wind, and they watched the lamps winking in the blue floor of the night 30 miles away. The judge crossed before them in the dark. Sparks from the fire ran down the wind. He took his seat among the scrabbled plates of shale out there, and so they sat, like beings from an older age, watching the distant lamps dim out one by one until the city on the plain had shrunk to a small core of light that might have been a burning tree, or some solitary encampment of travelers, or perhaps no ponderable fire at all. As they rode out through the tall wooden gates of the governor's palace, 2 soldiers who had been standing there counting them past stepped forward and took Toadvine's horse by the headstall. Glanton passed him on the right and rode on. Toadvine stood in the saddle. "Glanton!" The riders clattered into the street. Glanton, just beyond the gates, looked back. The soldiers were speaking to Toadvine in Spanish, and one held an escopeta on him.
"I ain't got nobody's teeth," Glanton said. "I'll shoot these 2 fools where they stand."
Glanton spat. He looked down the street and he looked at Toadvine. Then he dismounted and led his horse back into the courtyard.
"Vámonos," he said.
He looked up at Toadvine.
"Get off your horse."
They rode out of town under escort 2 days later. Upward of 100 soldiers herding them along the road, uneasy in their varied dress and arms, wrenching their horses about and booting them through the ford where the American horses had stopped to drink. In the foothills above the aqueduct, they reined to one side and the Americans filed past and wound up through the rocks and nopal and diminished among the shadows and were gone. They rode west into the mountains. They passed through small villages, doffing their hats to folk whom they would murder before the month was out. Mud pueblos that lay like plague towns with the crops rotting in the fields, and what stock not driven off by the Indians wandering at will and none to herd or tend it. And many villages almost wholly depopulated of male inhabitants, where the women and children crouched in terror in their hovels, listening until the last hoof-clop died in the distance. At the town of Nacori, there was a cantina, and here the company dismounted and crowded through the doorway and took tables. Tobin volunteered to guard the horses. He stood watching up and down the street. No one paid him any mind. These people had seen Americans in plenty, dusty, laggard trains of them, months out of their own country, and half-crazed with the enormity of their own presence in that immense and blood-slaked waste. Commandeering meal and meat, or indulging a latent taste for rape among the slow-eyed girls of that country. Now, it was something near to an hour past noon, and a number of workers and tradesmen were crossing the street toward the cantina. As they passed Glanton's horse, Glanton's dog rose up, bristling. They veered slightly and went on. At the same moment, a deputation of dogs of the village had started across the plaza, 5-6 of them, their eyes on Glanton's dog. As they did so, a juggler, leading a funeral, rounded the corner into the street. And taking a rocket from among several under his arm, he held it to the cigarillo in his mouth and tossed it into the plaza, where it exploded. The pack of dogs shied and scrambled back, save for two who continued into the street. Among the Mexican horses tethered at the bar before the cantina, several shot out a hind leg, and the rest stepped about nervously. Glanton's dog didn't take his eyes from the men moving toward the door. None of the American horses even raised an ear. The pair of dogs that had crossed in front of the funeral procession veered off from the kicking horses and came on toward the cantina. Two more rockets exploded in the street, and now the rest of the procession had swung into view, a fiddler and a cornet player, leading with a quick and lively tune. The dogs were trapped between the funeral and the animals of the mercenaries, and they halted and flattened their ears and began to sidle and trot. Finally, they bolted across the street behind the pallbearers. These details should have stood the workers entering the cantina in better stead. They had turned, and they stood now with their backs to the door, holding their hats to their chests. The pallbearers passed, carrying on their shoulders a bier, and the watchers could see in her burial dress among the flowers the gray-looking face of a young woman jostling along woodenly. Behind came her coffin, made from rawhide, blacked with lampblack, carried by dark-clad porters, and looking much like a rude hide boat. At the rear advanced a company of mourners, some of the men drinking. The old women, in their dusty black shawls, helped weeping over the potholes, and children bearing flowers, who looked shyly at the spectators in the street as they passed. Within the cantina, the Americans had no more than seated themselves before a muttered insult from a nearby table brought three or four of them to their feet. The Kid addressed the table in his wretched Spanish, and demanded which among those sullen inebriates had spoken. Before any could own it, the first of the funeral rockets exploded in the street, as told, and the entire company of Americans made for the door. A drunk at the table rose to his feet with a knife and lurched after them. His friends called after him, but he waved them away. John Dorsey and Henderson Smith, two boys from Missouri, were the first into the street. They were followed by Charlie Brown and the judge. The judge could see over their heads, and he raised one hand to those behind him. The beer was just passing. The fiddler and the cornetist were making little bows to each other, and their steps suggested the martial style of the air they played. "It's a funeral," said the judge. As he spoke, the drunk with the knife, now reeling in the doorway, sank the blade deep into the back of a man named Grimley. None saw it but the judge. Grimley put a hand on the rough wood frame of the door. "I'm killed," he said. The judge drew his belt pistol and leveled it above the heads of the men and shot the drunk through the middle of the forehead. The Americans outside the door were all but looking down the barrel of the judge's pistol when he fired, and most of them dove to the ground. Dorsey rolled clear and got to his feet, and collided with the workers who'd been paying their respects to the passing cortege. They were putting their hats on when the judge fired. The dead man fell backward into the cantina, blood spouting from his head. When Grimley turned, they could see the wooden handle of the knife protruding from his bloody shirt. Other knives were already in play. Dorsey was grappling with the Mexicans, and Henderson Smith had drawn his buoy and half-severed a man's arm with it. And the man was standing with the dark arterial blood spraying between his fingers where he tried to hold the wound shut. The judge got Dorsey to his feet, and they backed toward the cantina with the Mexicans feinting and jabbing at them with their knives. From inside came the uninterrupted sound of gunfire, and the door frame was filling up with smoke. The judge turned at the door and stepped over the several corpses sprawled there. Inside, the huge pistols roared without intermission, and the 20 or so Mexicans who'd been in the room were strewn about in every position, shot to pieces among the overturned chairs and the tables with the fresh splinters blown out of the wood and the mud walls pocked everywhere by the big conical bullets. The survivors were making for the daylight in the doorway, and the first of these encountered the judge there and cut at him with his knife. But the judge was like a cat, and he sidestepped the man and seized his arm and broke it, and picked the man up by his head. He put him against the wall and smiled at him, but the man had begun to bleed from the ears, and the blood was running down between the judge's fingers and over his hands, and when the judge turned him loose there was something wrong with his head, and he slid to the floor and did not get up. Those behind him had, meanwhile, met with a great battery of gunfire, and the doorway was jammed with the dead and dying, when there was suddenly a great ringing silence in the room. The judge stood with his back to the wall. The smoke drifted through the fog, and the shrouded figures stood frozen. In the center of the room, Toadvine and the kid were standing back to back with their pistols at port like duelists. The judge stepped to the door and shouted across the stacked bodies to the ex-priest, where he stood among the horses with his pistol drawn. "The laggards, priest! The laggards!" They'd not have shot men in public in a town so large, but there was no help for it. Three men were running down the street, and two others were legging in across the square. Of other souls abroad, there were none. Tobin stepped from between the horses and leveled the big pistol in both hands and began to fire, the pistol bucking and dropping back, and the runners wobbling and pitching headlong. He shot the two in the plaza and swung and shot down the runners in the street. The last one fell in a doorway, and Tobin turned and drew the other pistol from his belt and stepped to the other side of the horse and looked up the street and across the square for any sign of movement there or among the buildings. The judge stepped back from the doorway into the cantina, where the Americans stood looking at each other and at the bodies in a sort of wonder. They looked at Glanton. His eyes cut across the smoking room, his hat lying on a table. He stepped over and got it, and set it on his head and squared it. He looked about. The men were reloading the empty chambers in their pistols. "Here, boys," he said. "The string ain't run on this trade yet." When they left the cantina 10 minutes later, the streets were deserted. They had scalped the entire body of the dead, sliding about in a floor that had been packed clay and was now a wine-colored mud. There were 28 Mexicans inside the tavern and 8 more in the street, including the 5 the ex-priest had shot. They mounted up. Grimley sat slumped sideways against the mud wall of the building. He did not look up. He was holding his pistol in his lap and looking off down the street, and they turned and rode out along the north side of the plaza and disappeared. It was 30 minutes before anyone appeared in the street. They spoke in whispers. As they approached the cantina, one of the men from inside appeared in the doorway like a bloody apparition. He had been scalped, and the blood was all run down into his eyes, and he was holding shut a huge hole in his chest where a pink froth breathed in and out. One of the citizens laid a hand on his shoulder. "A donde vas?" he said. "A casa," said the man. The next town they entered was 2 days deeper into the Sierras. They never knew what it was called. A collection of mud huts pitched on the naked plateau. As they rode in, the people ran before them like harried game. Their cries to one another, or perhaps the visible frailty of them, seemed to incite something in Glanton. Brown watched him. He nudged forth his horse and drew his pistol, and the somnolent Pueblo was forthwith dragooned into a weltering shambles. Many of the people had been running toward the